Well, this week we're starting a new series, a five-week series out of the book of Ruth. I've told a couple people this morning, I think like a teacher, and so I laid out the series and it seemed obvious to me. As we'll find out, you know, Ruth is a very carefully constructed literary work, and each chapter is a discrete scene or an act. You could think of it like a play. All right, and so I thought, well, this is great. We'll do 1 week for each act, for each scene in the story, and I'll do just an intro, you know, where I'll do some background, some setting. We'll talk about the theological lens for the book. And I told my wife about halfway through this week, I said, you know, I'm almost done with the rough draft, and I've realized I don't really have a message yet. I just have all this background. If you're doing a class, you can do that, but I realized it might be a little awkward for you if I just gave you all this setting and then said, all right, see you next week. You'd think, well, what did we just do here, you know? So I figured it out. Don't worry. There is a message coming. But I do this morning, I do want to provide an overview and an introduction. And the main thing I want to do is I want to give you this morning the information that the author of Ruth is going to assume that you already have when you start reading the book. So that's my goal today. One thing that you're going to notice when we go through the book, as I already mentioned, is it's very carefully laid out. You have these four very clear scenes, and if you outlined it, it would look like this. You have a very short introduction or prologue in the first five verses, and then you have these four acts, right? So act one, we could call grief and loyalty. Act two, surprising kindness. Act three, a marriage proposal. And act four, blessing and faithfulness. And we'll see by the time we get to the end that it's designed so that the chapter four and chapter one almost become a mirror image of each other. Now, if you look at the first verse in Ruth, if you just open up to Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, you'll see that the author gives us an indication of what we need to know to understand the story. It gives us a little hint as readers. Verse 1 says that the events that follow take place in the days when the judges rule. In other words, the author is telling us, hey, if you want to fully understand this story, then you're going to, at a bare minimum, you're going to need to know about two different things. Number one, and most obviously, you need to know historically what was going on, what was happening in the book of Judges, and why. And number two, you're going to need to know about the covenant arrangement that God had made with the whole nation of Israel that serves as the theological backdrop, not just for Judges, but also for Ruth. So I want to start this morning with just a brief reminder of that covenant agreement with Israel at Sinai. Because again, that covenant, that agreement provides the crucial theological setting. I think it's helpful to think about that. That's the lens through which the author of Judges and the author of Ruth expect us to read and make sense of those stories. So, and what I think of as a very noble effort to keep this message under an hour, rather than walking through that sort of step by step, I'm going to do what Moses did. Moses, at the end of his life, right as Israel's entering the promised land, he offered a kind of summary, a distillation of the covenant. And so I'm just going to lean on the work that Moses already did here in Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 to 18. So we'll put it up on a slide here for you. This is right as the people of Israel, they've already made this covenant. They're just about to enter the promised land. And this is what Moses says. He says, see, I set before you today life and prosperity or death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. For then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away, and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and to worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and to possess. It's a pretty sobering moment. I mean, here they are. It's the moment that they've been building to for over a generation. They're finally going to enter this land that God had promised to them. It's also the end of Moses' life and his leadership of the people. And Moses takes this key moment, this pivotal moment, to remind them of their covenant with God. And he uses this simple but powerful metaphor. He tells them that two roads lie before them, and they will have to choose them, they and no one else. It's their choice what road they're going to take, right? So we've got a little handy slide here to help visualize this. Road one, Moses says, is the road of faithfulness, of covenant faithfulness that leads, that road leads to life and to prosperity. If they walk that road, if they are faithful to God, he will bless them. And they will increase. That's code for they'll have many children, right? They will prosper generally, and they will live long in this land that God has given to them. That's road one. So that's an option. Or, Moses says, you can take road two, the road of unfaithfulness and disobedience. If they take this road, if they turn away from God, and they give their loyalty to other gods, that road leads only to death and to self-destruction. They will not prosper. They will not live long in the land. Things will not go well for them. On the doorstep of the promised land, this is the choice that Moses puts before them. And he says, it's your choice, life or death. Prosperity or want, good or bad. And this will be crucial to remember, not just as we talk about Judges, but all the way as we go through Ruth, because this is the lens through which we're supposed to understand both stories. All right, so that's our theological lens, and now that we've got that, we can look through it at what's happening historically in the book of Judges. So, not only do we have that hint in verse 1, I'll just tell you, as we go through the book of Ruth, it will become obvious, I think, it's obvious to me, that the author of Ruth expects Judges not just to be sort of the generic setting or context for Ruth, but it's the background against which we should read Ruth, against which the faithfulness of Ruth can stand out all the more clearly. And that's because one way of thinking about Judges is that it's a sort of nation-level view of what happens when Israel chooses the road of unfaithfulness. So think again, you're a good reader of the Old Testament, you've just read through that portion of Deuteronomy, they're on the verge of entering the promised land, and you have just Moses himself drives this point home, two roads before you. All right, and then you read Joshua, they enter the land, they take possession of the land, most of the land, and now we get to Judges, and it's like you get to watch as they run a nationwide experiment on, is Moses telling the truth, right? Throughout the book, we watch as they choose again and again to turn from God, to turn from their covenant, and to turn toward other gods. And what we find out is the tragic results are exactly what Moses had warned them of. Disobedience to the covenant, generation after generation, leads to death and to destruction. It leads to enslavement and to poverty. As you read through Judges, it becomes obvious the people are not prospering. They are not living long in the land. They are not increasing in number. Judges is a vivid, discouraging portrait of national unfaithfulness that leads to national suffering. But, as we'll see in our series coming up here, not everyone is unfaithful. All right, so now you've got the theological lens, and you've got sort of the historical setting and backdrop. Now we're ready to jump into the book of Ruth. Those are the things the author assumes we're going to know as we start reading. So look with me, if you would, at Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. So here's the prologue. This is the setup for the story that comes. It says this, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab, and they remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. It's a discouraging opening, right? When we look at these verses, all right, just to show you how this works, through the lens of the covenant and against the backdrop of Judges, a few things become clear. First, when we read of the many tragedies in these verses, once again, one thing I think we're meant to see are the exact kinds of things that Moses had tried to warn them about in Deuteronomy 30. But where Judges sort of zooms out so you can see those consequences on a national level, Ruth zooms in on what those consequences look like for one family. And they are tragic and heartbreaking. I think it's helpful to think of the contrast here, right? Instead of the blessing and prosperity that God had wanted for them in the promised land, they experience a famine so severe that Elimelech leaves the promised land for Moab, the land of their hated neighbors. And instead of living long in that land and increasing in number and having many descendants, Elimelech and his sons both die prematurely, threatening the end of the family line and name. But good news, if Ruth 1:1-5 zooms in on the grief and tragedy of this one family walking this hard road of unfaithfulness, the rest of the book is going to zoom in on those who are left as they turn back toward God, as they choose to be faithful to him in his covenant. Again, if Judges is a sort of nationwide look at what happens when Israel breaks their covenant, Ruth is a family-level look at what happens when ordinary people respond with surprising faithfulness to God and to each other. And in the course of telling that story, this short book is going to explore two themes. I want to sort of end the message by just looking ahead to these two big themes. We'll take a look at each one in turn. First, when you read through those first few verses, when you read that prologue, one of the natural questions that should arise as you read that is, where is God in the midst of all of this suffering and loss? Where is God in the midst of these challenges and tragedies of ordinary life? I think part of what makes Ruth such a moving and powerful story is precisely this tight focus on ordinary people dealing with ordinary tragedies and challenges of everyday life. In the coming weeks, we're going to get to know this one family pretty well as they deal with the all too common tragedies of poverty and grief and loss. And the book is designed so that as these families encounter and walk through these hard things, that we as the readers walk along with them and we all wonder together, where is God in the midst of this? Where is God when Naomi loses first her husband and then both of her children in such a short period of time? Now, it's worth noting, that's a theme that gets explored many times throughout Scripture, many times just in the Old Testament. But Ruth's narrow focus on just a few people, I think, makes these questions both urgent and relatable. Man, there's this heart-rending scene near the end of chapter 1. We'll get into it more next week. When Naomi, she's decided to return, she's come back to Bethlehem, to the area where she grew up, where she's lived most of her life. And it looks at first like this joyful moment because her friends and family, the people she grew up with that she's known forever, they see her and they recognize her and they're so excited to welcome her back home. And they say, look, and they're gathering people around. You can kind of picture them like running up to her on the road in. Naomi has come back. Naomi has come home. And in this sort of heartbreaking moment, in the midst of all this joy, Naomi says to them, don't call me Naomi. It's a name that means sweet. She says, from now on, from here on out, I'm only going to answer to the name Mara, which means bitter. And she says, for the Lord has made me very bitter. I left here, she says, filled up, but God has brought me home empty. So no more calling me Naomi, no more calling me sweet. For God himself has afflicted me. He has brought misfortune on me. So call me Mara. Look, I'll tell you, at first blush, when I read that, like even just now, it makes me a little uncomfortable. It makes me a little nervous the way she so like openly and clearly just points the finger right at God. You have done this to me. And it's worth noting, she's playing a little fast and loose, not just with the theology, but even with the facts. She didn't leave filled up. They left because it was a famine. But here's the thing. I also have to admit to myself, I understand it. I mean, if you actually put yourself in her shoes, I mean, I'll just tell you, if you try to imagine what the last 10 years of life have been like for her, as a husband and a father, it's almost unbearable. I mean, can you imagine looking at your children and knowing they are so hungry and you have nothing to give them? A need so bad, so dire, that it would drive you to leave all the people and places you have ever known to go to this foreign country just in the hope that you might be able to find food for your family. And then you do that, you make this huge move, you leave everything you know behind, and you get there, and the three people you love most in the world all die. I mean, I can understand her anguish. And more than that, I can relate to it. And my guess is that you can too. You know, the truth is, those are words I have thought in the privacy of my own mind and heart, when I have been in the midst of grief and loss and tragedy. I have sat with people in the middle of loss, in the middle of suffering, and I have wondered in my own heart and mind, God, where are you? Where are you in the middle of all of this? My guess is that you have too. As we'll see in the coming weeks, Ruth offers a powerful answer to this question. You see, in Act 1, Naomi thinks she believes that God has left her to face this grief alone. She thinks that he has abandoned her, that he has left her empty. But time and circumstances will prove her wrong. God has never left her, and he has never abandoned her. And as the story unfolds, what we find is that the goodness and faithfulness of God finds repeated and relentless expression in the faithfulness of God's people. God blesses and comforts Naomi first through the surprising faithfulness of her Moabite daughter-in-law, Ruth. And later, God will comfort and encourage her. He will lift her up through the cheerful generosity and integrity of her kinsman Boaz. The simple but powerful faithfulness of these two people, through them, God restores Naomi to life and to peace, and in the end, we'll find, he will secure her line and family for generations, all through the faithfulness of these two ordinary people. A second question explored in the book is, how does God accomplish his purposes when nothing around them is as it should be? Part of what makes the book of Judges so discouraging, again, for an informed reader of the Old Testament, is that Israel was supposed to be the people through which God was going to bring his blessing and wise rule to all creation. That's the narrative of the Old Testament. God had chosen Abraham and his descendants to be his partners. All right, he had made a covenant, not just with them, but later with the whole nation. He had given them the promised land. He had made his glory to dwell, especially in their midst. And then on top of all of that, he gives them the Torah. He gives them this clear instruction on how to partner with him in his work to rescue creation and how to avoid the snares and slavery of sin. But even with all of that in their favor, Israel proves susceptible to the same folly and weakness as everyone else. It turns out they are no worse than any other people, but they're also no better either. And it leaves us as the readers wondering, what is God going to do now? I mean, watching Israel flounder in the book of Judges, it's supposed to feel like you've been stranded on a desert island out in the middle of the ocean for months, and when at last you see the rescue boat on the horizon, you watch it sink. I mean, what do you do when even the rescue has failed? I mean, how does God's purpose go forward when even the rescuers fall short? Well, here too, Ruth provides, I think, one of the most poignant and concise responses to this frequent biblical lament. The message of Ruth is that our God accomplishes extraordinary things through the everyday faithfulness of ordinary people. The camp I worked at and went to growing up, when I was a counselor there, when I was in college, they had added this experience they called teepee camp. Now, it's a much smaller camp than Chaminade. We don't have a lake, so we couldn't do an island camp. But we had a lot of woods, and so they went back just far enough in the woods to make it interesting. And they built these two raised wooden platforms, and they put these two big teepees on it. And the idea was you'd get two counselors in each teepee and about 15 boys, 15 to 20 boys in one, 15 to 20 girls in the other. And you would have this like separate experience there at camp. You'd sleep in the teepee. You would prepare your meals or often reheat them over an open fire with varying degrees of success and edibility, right? But you were out there. I mean, you were sleeping outside. You were doing everything outside. And you were with this group, this one group, the whole time. And so it was. It was kind of a cool experience. I will say the first of the 2 weeks we did it, I got asked to be one of the counselors. I wasn't excited about it exactly. You don't sleep well. You're just sleeping on wood in a sleeping bag. It's summer. Everything's damp all the time. You're crammed in there with kids who are wound up. And, you know, the big thing to me is instead of, like, just walking into the dining hall where someone has prepared food for you, like, they just drop off stuff in the morning, and they're like, good luck. And at that time, my skills vis-a-vis food production were not good, all right? I even tried to say, like, I don't know that people are going to be able to eat something I've made over a fire. I didn't know Doug Nelson at that point. So they said, no problem, you'll be fine. And we were fine. It was every bit as hard as I thought it was going to be, but it was also cool. There were some really neat relationships that came out of that. But I was more than happy the second week to go back to sleeping inside my cabin, at least on a mattress in a bunk bed. But that week, four friends of mine rotated in. They were the counselors. And on about Tuesday of that week, we got an Ohio Classic, which was like 48 consecutive hours of constant cloud cover. Not pouring rain, but just constant rain. And I just, like, when that thing rolled in, I just felt terrible for the counselors. I mean, I felt relieved that it wasn't me, but I felt terrible for them, okay? Because I knew that everything hard about TP camp just got 10 times harder. The food plan, in case you're wondering, is still good luck, all right? We dropped it off, do your best. Hard to keep that fire going in the constant rain. Those teepees are open-ish to the elements. There's a little hole in the top, and it is amazing. I just knew, like, Tuesday, I was like, Nothing they have, their bedding, their clothing, nothing will be dry for the rest of the week. That's where you're at. And I just thought, all I could think was, I'm not sure I could have handled that. Like, I would be miserable. I would just be crabby. And the kids, like, all the activities, by the way, they're all outdoors. So everything that had been planned for you, that's all off the table, right? And it's now like, do what you can where you can, you know? And I'm thinking, man, these poor kids, they came to have this, like, cool experience, and now they're just, they're going to be miserable. They're going to be crabby. I just thought, this is going to be a disaster. These counselors are going to quit, and these kids are not going to come back to camp. It seemed unbearable. So the second day of rain, as my cabin, we're like trying to dart back across the field in the rain from the main buildings, all of a sudden we hear this like just roar, this like primal, you know, joyful, scary roar. And we look over towards the trail into the woods, which by now, if you step in it, you sink to your ankle. It's just mud. This mud track back into the woods. Out of this mud track comes this horde of kids who are just covered in mud from head to toe with their counselors. They're all in their swimsuits, just caked in mud, just full of joy. Just running, screaming, washing off in the rain. And we are all like cowering, trying to like not get a little bit damp. And I was just gobsmacked. And I later found out that these counselors, unlike I would have done, they said, hey, you came for teepee camp. This is teepee camp. It rains, we get wet, but we still have fun. And the one day they were supposed to do a slip and slide, and the counselor said, oh, we're still doing the slip and slide. And they set it up on purpose so that you would slide off the end of this thing right down this mud track. And of course, for the middle school kids or a little younger who were there, this is what they've wanted to do their whole life and their parents have never let them do, right? They had the best time. And, you know, even watching them, all I could think is, what are they going to do with all these, like, mud cake swimsuits when this is over? But the counselor said, we'll be fine. And what they decided is that they were going to be unselfish, is that they were not going to put their needs and their concerns ahead of those kids. They were going to put they wanted those kids to learn about Jesus and have a good time doing it, and they weren't going to let anything get in the way. And I'll tell you, it's like, I've never been more shocked. I was so sure it was going to be a complete disaster. And yet, on the day of parent pickup, I didn't talk to a single kid from teepee camp who did not tell me this is the best week I've ever had at camp. And I'll tell you what, you know what's amazing? There was no supernatural intervention to make that happen. No one prayed for the rain to stop and it miraculously stopped. But God showed up in an incredible way. He transformed this miserable experience into something special and memorable that they are going to just hold on to for years and years. But he did it through the ordinary faithfulness of four counselors who chose not to be selfish and to put those kids first. Because that's what our God specializes in doing extraordinary things through ordinary people. And friends, that's exactly the lesson and message and encouragement that is at the heart of the book of Ruth. Listen, we'll go through it, you'll find out. There's no kings in the book of Ruth, all right? There's no great prophets. There's no, you know, really extra special officer type people here. This is just a farmer and his relatives, okay? And yet God does something extraordinary. And it's just as true now as it was then. Look, I know it's easy to get discouraged when we look around us. Sometimes, right? Sometimes it's the immediate events of our life, the life of the people we care most about, the people most around us. Sometimes we're in the middle of it. I was talking to a friend who's they're dealing with some hard stuff, and he said, hey, you know what we've learned through this is everyone has their own stuff. You just don't know about it. And he's right. All of us have those moments where the stuff happening to us, it just seems like, man, where is God and what could he possibly do with this? Sometimes, right, it's larger circumstances. It's citywide, nationwide, culture-wide. and we look around and we throw up our hands and we say, how are God's purposes possibly going to go forward when nothing in this picture is as it should be? It's easy to be overwhelmed, easy to wonder, no doubt, as many did in Ruth's day, where is God and how can he possibly work in the middle of this mess? And the answer, I'm happy to tell you, now as then, is that our God is expert in accomplishing extraordinary things through the everyday faithfulness of people just like you and me, if we will just be faithful. Would you close with me in prayer? Heavenly Father, we thank you for that truth. And Lord, I confess that as much as I love it, I for some reason find it hard to hold on to, even in my own life. Lord, the amazing thing that is present from the very first page to the last page of your word is that you delight to work in and through everyday normal people just like us. And yet, Lord, so often we are looking for the solution somewhere else, anywhere else. And the truth is that you are right there, working and present every day and in all these situations, often, Lord, most powerfully, most clearly, through the ordinary faithfulness of your people. God, I pray that as we are reminded of that in the coming weeks, that it might both convict us and inspire us, that we might recognize the incredible opportunity that we have to be participants in your work and in your joy as we are faithful to your covenant and we get to see you work through us in powerful and extraordinary ways. Help us, God, in the midst of a sometimes chaotic and sinful and challenging world, to be your faithful people. In your name we pray. Amen.